Welcome back to the program. Now that the war in Iraq is winding down, just maybe we can go back and look at why there really was an Iraq war. Not because of the so-called weapons of mass destruction that Saddam allegedly had, but because one man had made it his life's mission from the time he was a teenager to overthrow Saddam. Over the years, he tried many ways, but none would be more successful for Ahmad Chalabi than co-opting the Bush administration, the CIA, the New York Times, and the Defense Department. How did he pull it off, and in so doing precipitate what may very well be the biggest and most expensive foreign policy blunder in United States history? We're going to look at this story today with my guest, Richard Bonin. He's a producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes, where he's won 5 Emmys, as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting from Iraq. It is my pleasure to welcome Richard Bonin here to talk about his new book, Arrows of the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. Richard Bonin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Great to have you here. The kind of penultimate moment is really arguably the moment that you begin the book with, when on day 2 of the Bush administration, Ahmad Chalabi was meeting with some of the foreign policy leaders in the Bush administration.
On January 21st, 2001, Richard Perle, a leading neoconservative, convenes a meeting in his living room just outside of the nation's capital. And there, along with Ahmad Chalabi, is Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, Zal Khalilzad, and John Hanna, all of whom within a matter of 8 to 10 weeks would have senior positions in the administration. Wolfowitz and Feith would be the number 2 and 3 guys at the Pentagon. John Hanna became a national security advisor to Vice President Cheney, and Zal Khalilzad became an advisor to President Bush. And they meet on the second day of the presidency. They all just spent the day before celebrating Bush's victory. And Richard Perle opens the meeting and he says, well, now we have won and it's time to get our agenda going. And their agenda was to overthrow Saddam Hussein and put Ahmad Chalabi in his place.
One of the questions that arises from that is whether or not this was kind of the perfect storm that had come together here. Whether it was Chalabi through his life's work that we'll talk about, that it had such influence in persuading many of these guys that Saddam needed to be overthrown, or whether they had simply come to the idea from a different place and that this was the perfect blending of forces.
Yeah, well, that's a very apt description, the perfect storm. I mean, there were currents of history that all came together. And one of Chalabi's geniuses was to be able to recognize those currents of history and capitalize on them, ride them to his ultimate destination. And one of those ways of history was the neoconservative movement. For their own reasons, for their own philosophy, their own sense of patriotism, they thought it was in the U.S. interest to confront evil, to confront dictators like Saddam, and there's no doubt he was evil, to confront him on the battlefield and remove him from power and implant the seeds of democracy in the Middle East. Chalabi had his own reasons, but here these two forces met in the mid-1990s and recognized in one another that they were each other's path forward to realizing their own dreams.
The other irony of Chalabi and the neoconservatives is the fact that when Chalabi first came to Washington, essentially knowing nobody, as you write about it, that he looked to AIPAC as kind of a model in the way that a foreign policy issue, in that case Israel, had turned into a domestic political discussion.
Exactly. He studied here in the U.S. in the 1960s. He was at MIT getting his degree in math, then at the University of Chicago, and he observed the anti-war protests of Vietnam and how that forced the President Johnson out of office. And what he realized then and never forgot is that when foreign policy becomes domestic policy, then you can move the needle in your direction. And that was the model of AIPAC. No, there is no more powerful foreign policy lobby in the U.S. than the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and he modeled his efforts on them to make Iraq a domestic U.S. issue. And what's remarkable is when he came here in the mid-1990s, you know, the Clinton White House was against them, the CIA was against them, the State Department was against them, the Arab states in the Middle East were against him, and he had no constituency in America. And he systematically courted people of power to come to his side, to join him in his battle to make Iraq a domestic policy, and he succeeded wildly.
And this was a mission that he had been on literally since he was a teenager.
This is true. He grew up in old Iraq when it was ruled by a monarchy, and his father was the single wealthiest Iraqi in the country. He was the Rockefeller of Iraq. And in 1958, that monarchy was overthrown, and the Shalabis were forced to flee Iraq. I mean, it was a brutal revolution. Close friends of theirs were literally hacked to death, and their chunks of their body ripped from their corpses. It was, you know, a very devastating experience. He fled to London. Their lives were completely turned upside down, politically, financially, emotionally. And Chalabi devoted himself from age 14 to returning to Iraq, to restoring the family honor. Honor is very important in the Arab male psyche, and he devoted himself to that. And at age 14, his method of getting back was to make himself smart, devote himself to learning. And he studied things like the Russian Revolution and the Communist Revolution. He studied how Lenin used Germany to overthrow the Tsarist government in Russia and put him in power and ride European history for Lenin's own purposes. I mean, this is the kind of things he's studying as a teenager. It's just remarkable.
And there's a definitive moment, arguably, that you talk about when the family has sort of lost it all and he sees his father cooking rice. And it's sort of this transformative moment.
It is. It's a revelation for him. When in Iraq, his father was so wealthy and so powerful. I mean, they lived in a huge property. They were surrounded by guards, by T-boys, by manservants. I mean, they didn't do anything for themselves. And all of a sudden, they are in London renting a flat where a small apartment with beat up couches and white walls, and there is his father cooking a bowl of rice. Chalabi had never seen his father cook, and it was a stunner to him. It was a revelation that he said, "Oh my God, things have changed. I cannot be a burden for my family. I have to take responsibility for my life." And that is the moment he began to think about getting back to Iraq at age 14.
There was also this sense that as a Shiite, that there was a glass ceiling, and that further bred his resentment.
And that was the paradox of his upbringing. I mean, Iraq is a Shia majority country that has always been led by the Sunnis. His father managed to rise to the pinnacle of economic power and political power despite being a Shia in a Sunni-led country. But there was a glass ceiling. Ultimate power always rested with the Sunni-led military. And despite the family's success, they harbored a deep sense of resentment about the Sunni control. And that played a huge role that none of us really understood when Chalabi was making his way through Washington, that he was driven by this desire for putting the Shia putting the Sunnis in their place and delivering a Shia revival in Iraq.
That combination, one wanting to see that redressed, the whole Sunni-Shiite balance, plus the sense of his family's loss, was really, those were powerful forces.
Yeah, they were probably the twin drivers of his motivation. And, you know, what's remarkable is, you know, there were these historical and personality qualities that not only drove him, but he was then able to foist upon the international stage and actually, win over the United States, the sole superpower on the planet, and also to insinuate himself within the inner sanctum of Iran, you know, based on this sense of shame he felt about his father having been forced out of Iraq, and the sense of resentment that he harbored about being a Shia in a Sunni-led country.
And all of this would come together in what he ultimately would develop in his own mind and would proselytize a kind of new vision, his vision for the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, what he wanted was a Shia ascendancy. He wanted for Iraq to become an economic, political, and cultural oasis in the Middle East, and he saw himself as a figure of history who could make that happen. And in addition to overthrowing Saddam, in addition to rising to the leadership of Iraq for himself, he saw himself as a man of history who would implant modernity in the heart of the Middle East. That was his ultimate grand, maybe grandiose, vision.
Talk about his relationship with the CIA and the Iraqi National Congress, which really was kind of a CIA cover.
Yeah, you know, prior to 1990, prior to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, the U.S. would have nothing to do at all with the Iraqi opposition, those who opposed Saddam, completely cut off all relations with them. But after Saddam invaded Kuwait, that broke the bond between Washington and Baghdad, and they started the first President Bush ordered the CIA to come up with a plan to destabilize and ultimately overthrow Saddam. So the CIA organized a two-pronged covert operation. One prong, which was the heart of it, was to get generals within Saddam's inner circle to overthrow Saddam and take over the country. And it would still be Sunni-led, and it would be anti-Iranian. That was the key. But in order to make that happen, the CIA wanted a political cover. So they created a political opposition group called the Iraqi National Congress, and one of the people they recruited, they came knocking on Chalabi's door, was Chalabi. They asked him to join and help create the face of the opposition. Now, ultimately, the opposition was just a facade. Once the generals overthrew Saddam, the CIA was going to discard Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress. And Chalabi quickly figured this out and decided rather than he being an asset of the CIA, he was going to make the CIA an asset of his ambitions, and he hijacked the operation. And so he used the CIA to get himself situated in Iraqi Kurdistan, where he began to develop a base of power of his own. And, you know, that lasted for several years, but by late 1996, very early 1997, the CIA had had enough of him, and they cut him off. They issued what's called a burn notice on him and would have nothing to do with him from about January 1977 forward.
One of the things this goes to the heart of is one of Chalabi's skills that you talk about is this kind of master manipulator that even started, you saw signs of it even when he was in boarding school.
Yes, you know, it's in his DNA, and he's actually quite proud of it. When he was in boarding school, at, again, the tender age of 13, one of the things he did, which was so funny, was he didn't like the food they ate there, and he didn't like the commotion of the cafeteria and all of that. So he arranged this elaborate system where he had his parents sneak in very expensive, delicious food to him, and in order to be able to stay in his dorm and eat it, not have to go to the cafeteria, he had his parents give him money, he bought cigarettes, he had a local store sell his cigarettes to the upperclassmen, who all looked the other way and let Chalabi do what he wanted. And so, I mean, since age 13, he's been organizing elaborate schemes, and he was building his way until he got to the world stage.
And on that world stage, part of the Chalabi scheme, part of the manipulation, was creating this illusion of weapons of mass destruction.
Well, you know, a lot of, in his defense about that, I mean, most every Western intelligence agency truly believed Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And I think Chalabi genuinely did. What he did, however, was procure defectors from Iraq who said they knew firsthand about those weapons of mass destruction when, in fact, they didn't. And in one case, according to the U.S. government, his group coached the defector how to lie effectively about his so-called firsthand experience. And, you know, and those defectors played a key role in justifying the U.S. decision to invade Iraq. Their testimony was public. He made them available to the New York Times, to 60 Minutes, to Vanity Fair, to every major publication in the U.S. And their reports flooded the intelligence agencies of the U.S. government, hundreds of them, and, you know, and even were shared with allied nations, and all of which gave crucial and timely support to the notion that Saddam had WMD when he didn't. And it helped create the political support for President Bush's ultimate decision to invade.
Who were the holdouts that you found in the administration? Who didn't buy in entirely to Chalabi?
Well, what's remarkable is that the administration was completely divided about Chalabi and deadlocked on him. The CIA hated him. They considered him an opportunist and a charlatan. The State Department pretty much felt the same way. And some members of the National Security Council in the White House felt the same way. But his support mostly existed on the civilian side in the Pentagon, Wolfowitz and Feith, mm-hmm. in the office of the Secretary of Defense, and within Vice President Cheney's office. And from those two corners of the administration, Chalabi enjoyed remarkable success. I mean, his ambition and his vision for overthrowing Saddam was actually briefed to President Bush by Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, that's how far he got.
And they were all very good at marshaling their case. I mean, they had Chalabi, who was, as we've talked about, this great manipulator, and a lot of bureaucratic infighters that really knew how to make the case.
Well, A, they were all brilliant. They are all brilliant men on their own. Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Ahmed Chalabi. But, you know, there was also reasonable men and women could argue and disagree about the virtues of overthrowing Saddam. I mean, let's not forget, this was the most brutal and evil dictator probably since, you know, Stalin and Hitler. He killed something like 1 million of his own people, used chemical weapons on his own people. He had invaded two countries, Kuwait and Iran. I mean, there was reason to be concerned about him. And I must say, you know, I traveled to Iraq during the Saddam era and a couple or three times. And every time I was there, I used to think, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. Can you imagine being born in this place and having your life wasted? You could not think a free thought. You could not even share your thoughts with your friends, sometimes even your family. And, you know, there, to me, you know, apart from WMD, there was a moral component and a certain nobility to opposing Saddam. And you have to give Chalabi his due on that, as well as the neoconservatives. But, you know, the question of, but that's not the basis on which they argued for this war. They said Saddam was connected to 9/11, and everybody knew he wasn't. They said Saddam had WMD, and while many people thought he did, there were many inside the CIA who argued, you know, the case isn't that strong. And you know, and they led us into a war that we have come to rue.
You met Chalabi in London shortly after 9/11. Talk about that, Richard.
Well, I met him in January of 2002. Yeah. So after 9/11, I mean, we all here at 60 Minutes just bore into the terrorism story, and it quickly became a debate within the administration about whether or not to include Iraq. And I quickly discovered that the man at the heart of this debate was Ahmed Chalabi. Who is this guy? And, and I remember my bosses in New York thinking, come on, this cowboy, the former governor of Texas, George Bush, is going to embrace Ahmed Chalabi, this Iraqi exile with a taste for expensive Italian suits. We don't think so. But, you know, they were good enough to let me to travel to London to meet him, and his office was right there on Knightsbridge by Hyde Park, which is a very upscale part of London, and I walked into his office, and there he was, surrounded by this hubbub of activity. He's barking out orders in Arabic to his employees. He's got Saddam's order of battle spread out on his desk, and he's taking calls left and right from some of these neoconservatives who are working inside the Bush administration or who are on the outside and aiding the argument to invade Iraq. And I said, you know what? This guy is no mere dandy. He is well-connected. He is on the ground floor of the emerging debate about whether or not to include Iraq in the response to 9/11. And that's how, you know, and that began a 10-year-long relationship with him.
Talk about his relationship with Iran and how that has evolved over this period of time.
Well, you know, he first hooked up with the Iranians in the 1960s when he, as a teenager, when he participated in his second coup attempt. And he met the head of the Shah's intelligence service, the Savak. And you know, that began a very long and what would become controversial relationship with the Iranians. But by time the 1990s came around and he was working with the CIA there in northern Iraq and Kurdistan, the Iranians became very suspicious of him. They thought he was doing the work of the great Satan, and so did the Iraqi Islamic parties that supported Iran. And Chalabi's position could have become very untenable. The Iranians could have undermined him if they wanted to. So Chalabi told me this story. He says, what do you do when the Islamic Republic of Iran is suspicious of you and opposes you? You go over their heads. So he understood Iranian politics like American politics. And going over their heads in Iran means going to the Ayatollahs. So he traveled to the religious center of Iran, Qom, and met with two Ayatollahs, and basically asked them for a fatwa, for a religious license, to work with, of all things, the CIA or the U.S. government to overthrow Saddam. And that's where he invoked the Shia prayer that became the title of my book, Arrows of the Night. And he asked one of the Ayatollahs to join him in the prayer, Arrows of the Night, where at nighttime you ask God to answer your prayers like arrows directed at your enemies. And the Ayatollah joined him, blessed his collaboration with the great Satan, and from that point on, Chalabi steadily began to build a closer relationship with the Iranian political operatives and Iranian intelligence. And by the time 2003, the invasion occurred, Chalabi basically had a mirror image relationship in Iran with, as he did in Washington. If he had Richard Perlman with the neoconservatives in Washington, he had the mirror images of those people who were backing him in Tehran. And it was brilliant. He balanced these two implacable foes to work together, and he was the man in the middle.
And what is the status of Chalabi today?
Well, you know, his vision was to be a man of history, to be the leader of Iraq, and it didn't quite work out that way. After the U.S. cut ties with him completely, first in 2004 and then 2008, he you know, his rise to the top got sidelined, and he is now much, much closer to Iran, and they're his chief sponsor, and he is a member of parliament. He is one of 325, and not where he wanted to be, but he works hard, and he works every day to get to where he wants to be. He has not given up, and he is as wily and as manipulative as ever.
Fair to say we've not seen the end of Ahmad Chalabi.
No, you will not see the end of Ahmad Chalabi until he is in the ground with his ancestors.
Richard Bonin, the book is Arrows of the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. It's just out from Doubleday. Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back. Richard, thank you so much.
Did that work well?
That was great.
Terrific. Thank you much, Jeff.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.